Welcome to the GBC Big Three podcast, a weekly podcast where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised during our Sunday sermons. I'm your host, Matt Willis, and joining us back again on the Big Three couch after what can only be described as a lifetime is Jodine Watling. Jodes, where have you been? What have you been doing? Tell me everything, but tell it to me quick.
I think the rest of people, I've been power walking around my suburb and investigating and finding new places to walk. So that's been great. I've been out stand-up paddleboarding and I think doing a deep spring clean of everything I can find.
I've got to admit, like catching up and chatting about what's been going on, like I feel like you've been living your best ISO life.
I have been living my best ISO life, thanks. Thanks for asking.
Just flourished.
Flourishing, yes.
It's that silver lining. It's beautiful. And back again after another cracker of a message on Sunday, we have Mark Rader. Now, Mark, you kicked us off in a series in the book of Hebrews. What led you to choosing that epistle? What makes it significant for us at this time?
I think the critical piece in it is the warning that the whole book is wrapped around, that warning of drifting away from Jesus. And it just occurred to me, you know, like I think initially, you know, one of our concerns as a staff and as a leadership is that we want to, you know, create an online, you know, service, for instance, that people can still attend and feel connected to. And, you know, I'd be lying if there wasn't that kind of lurking fear that people are going to kind of drift away from us.
Yeah.
And just kind of that realization that that's not actually the big fear here. Like drifting from Gaimia is not the problem. It's the opportunity to drift away from Jesus. And just knowing in my own life the power of routine and those regular rhythms. And all of a sudden, like I've noticed it even in my own life, it's very different on a Sunday. It's just really different on a Sunday. You know, I still attend church three times, but it's just a lot different. And just kind of being out of that rhythm and realizing how easily it is then for us just to kind of drift away. So I thought that it was a really kind of, for me personally, it was a reminder that the most important thing is that we're not drifting away from Jesus. And secondly, I think then it was a word for us as a church that, you know, in the midst of a lot of our routines being disrupted, to not allow that to give us an excuse either.
Well, great. I've got to admit, like week one, I feel like we're in for a wild ride. It's going to be a great series. You can listen to that message again through our regular GBC Sermons podcast. But today, as always, we'll be unpacking three big questions submitted through Slido during our Sunday services. So guys, let's get into the big three. Well, Mark, I'll start with you. You helpfully provided a bit of an overview to the context in which Hebrews is being written into. You explained a couple of really defining features to the Greco-Roman culture that the audience of Hebrews is living within. And you spoke about two key threads of their society. The first being the honor and shame system. This idea, and I'm sorry if I butcher this completely, but that's fine. This whole idea that honor is like the number one commodity. Everyone's after it. Everyone needs it. Everyone wants it. And the more honor you have, the more influence, connection, status you hold. But having said that, to do something dishonorable meant that you would have shame, that your family, friends, people who knew you could potentially be shamed as a result. And shame was a stain that's not easily removed. And then that would then play into this second thread that you spoke about, which was a pretty defining feature for Hebrews, which is this patron-benefactor relationship. You know, the patron was someone who had a lot of honor, a lot of connection and status, and so they'd use that to benefit their benefactor, keep them connected and whatnot, and then the benefactor would then give more honor to their patron. And you tied that into, and I guess the author of Hebrews really ties that into Jesus and our relationship with Jesus and how that's really significant. And that's the context that really Hebrews kind of focuses around. Now that leads us to our first question. How does the patron-benefactor relationship maintain its significance for us when we no longer exist within an honor shame society?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, it's a good summary.
Thank you.
You've obviously listened at least twice.
At least to that, right?
So well played.
Well, just, I can go home now.
you never cease to astound me.
Just what I thought. Wow.
So now, and I should probably say that a lot of my thinking on that was shaped by De Silva's commentary on Hebrews that focuses on what's called socio-rhetorical criticism, looking at both the rhetorical features of the letter and the social context in which it's written. So I was I found his commentary very influential. It's an excellent commentary if you're looking to get a commentary on the book of Hebrews. but I think that the patron benefactor language is certainly helpful to make sense of Hebrews, but it still makes some sense for us today. To some degree, that even though we don't have, at least in Australia, an honor-shame culture, my understanding of many Asian cultures is that they still have a much stronger honor and shame culture.
Yeah.
And so I think people who are from an Asian background, particularly first generation or second generation, they would have a much clearer understanding of that than you or I would. But I think the patron benefactor language still kind of works for us today because it's the representation of that phrase, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Yep.
Right? And we've all had those experiences where something that for most people is really complicated becomes easy for us because I knew somebody. Right? Like I knew somebody and they connected me directly to this person who kind of got me through kind of priority. And while when it happens, you know, when we don't receive that, we feel like it's been an injustice. we're usually happy to be the one who benefits from it, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I think, and that's largely how the world works. You know, like you bump up against something, you think, oh, who can I call? Who can I talk to? Oh, I know. I'll call Matt because he knows someone, you know, or whatever it might be. I'll chat to Jodes because she used to work for that organization and maybe she knows someone that I can talk to. That just kind of smooths things a little bit. And I think that kind of patron-benefactor relationship is what is most valuable for us to kind of take away from it. I think the difference is that for the first century, it was kind of almost institutionalized. Right, it was a really significant part of the fabric. Whereas, I think, you know, personally, I think that Western democratic capitalistic societies could do with some shaming of very wealthy people who are not benefactors. Sorry, who are not patrons of those around us. You know, like you look at, there are lots of wealthy people who do lots of great stuff in the world, and that's good. But there's a bunch of them who are just, you know, like they just accumulate stuff, and we don't have any social shaming mechanism to kind of go, what are you doing with $300 billion? Like, so I think there'd be some benefit to that.
Oh, we definitely are a shameless society. I'll give us that. That's right. All you have to do is scroll through social media a little bit, and you're like, not a lot of shame. Not a lot of shame going around.
So I think the piece for us where it kind of falls down is because it's not formalized for us, it's that kind of gentle, you know, it's who you know, that would almost, I think it then, when you translate it to the relationship with Jesus, doesn't feel quite as strong as it would have been the first century.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Jadine, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, it was really interesting to think because obviously being from Australia from a Western kind of cultural perspective, we're not honour and shame, but we're more good, bad, right, wrong, guilt, innocence. So honour and shame doesn't necessarily motivate us whilst we can experience it. I guess for us it's more like it is really, really good and healthy and, you know, just the best thing you can do is to follow Jesus so you don't drift. Like that's the framework we would put it in.
Yeah.
Whereas it's not good to drift. It's unhealthy to drift. So just sort of thinking, flipping it in a construct that we would sort of examine from a Western perspective is kind of helpful. I think of exercise and eating healthy. You know, we all know it's the good thing to do, but do we do it? No. Mm-mm. But I also think guilt isn't a great motivator to get you to do something. So I think understanding the goodness of exercise and eating healthy or understanding the goodness of Jesus is the thing that's going to motivate us towards him.
Yeah.
I think
one
of the other kind of cultural frameworks is actually competition.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about winning at life.
Yes.
Totally. You know?
Yes, we do.
You know, and so I think that there's also a competitive edge to our culture that I think also perhaps frames up for us how we think then about life in faith. Like so often we think about not so much about, we think about what's good for us in order that we might get ahead.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that's one of the reasons why that whole wealth and health prosperity gospel kind of is so insidious.
Yeah.
because it speaks into not just the good of wealth and health and all that sort of stuff, but I'm winning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with God in my corner, I'm going to get ahead and I'm going to experience the blessing. And we put all the Christian language around it.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because, like, as soon as you said it, I was like, yes, we like that competitive nature is definitely, I think, a really significant driving force for us. You know, that whole, I want to win, I want to be ahead, I want to be perceived as successful. And, you know, the idea of failure, you know, I don't want to be vulnerable, I don't want people to see my weaknesses, all that kind of stuff.
Well, and capitalism too.
Yeah. Like, I totally see that. I think one of the difficulties, though, is in comparison to, like, first century Greco-Roman culture, is back then it was all agreed upon around what gave you honor and what gave you shame. Whereas in our society, it's subjective. Winning to me is the following Jesus, is the living my life in line with his teachings. That's losing for someone else. And so that, in and of, like, that shade of gray can, well, again, make it difficult.
Well, except that that's exactly the point that the author to the Hebrews is trying to make. Because he's got a group of people who are following after Jesus, and they are now beginning to act in a shameful way. And he's trying to say to them, listen, this is shameful. This is shameful, what you're doing. You're thinking of drifting away from Jesus. What are you, like, how could you neglect this? You wouldn't neglect a patron in your real life, right? So, like, why would you? And so I think what he's trying to do is they've made a decision to follow after Jesus because they thought that was the honorable thing to do. They're struggling now with how that works in their wider culture. And so I think it does work, whether you frame it up as, you know, we see following Jesus as the good or as winning. It doesn't really matter what framework you use within that. There'd be lots of people in our society and culture who would say, no, following Jesus means you're losing. Following Jesus is not the good. Like, it's just this, whatever, however they want to frame it up. And I think one of the things that the book of Hebrews is trying to do is try to reassert that community, right, where you get your values. Why is it and so important to continue to meet together? It's important to meet together because you support each other's values. You reinforce the values that we live by. And what are the values we live by? Where Jesus is the good, where Jesus is winning, where, you know, where Jesus is honorable. So I think it does. It's still compatible with the overall message in that wider kind of context.
Absolutely. And I think, I don't know, I just find it very helpful when we bring scripture into our modern context, because sometimes bridging that gap can be hard for us. So great stuff. Love it. Well, moving on, Mark, I'll come back to you. Obviously, this section of passage in Hebrews, the first few verses of chapter 2, it's a warning against drifting away. And, you know, we've spoken about that a lot already. And I guess the thing that you mentioned was that this community, they weren't necessarily renouncing their faith. They weren't making overt kind of declarations of I'm walking away. But, you know, it was this subtle, slow process of just moving away from Jesus. And I guess that's the thing about drifting away. There is a subtlety to it. It can happen you can be quite unaware of it. And I guess if I can push the analogy a bit too far, you know, growing up on the coast of Australia, in the beach, you know, you can be past the break before you realize you're in a rip. And it's not until you start trying to swim back that you realize how far you've gone and how much is pushing you in another direction. And so it just kind of got me thinking around this whole idea that drifting away, it is subtle, it is silent, and it can actually happen quite fast. And it's from that our second question stems from. What are the signs? What are the things that I can be looking out for in my life that indicate that I might be unintentionally drifting away?
It's a good question. I think that, you know, as you point out, I think one of the key indicators of one of the things that happens when we drift is that we're a bit negligent, right? You know, there's something lovely about getting on an inner tube or a flotation device of some description and just lying back and not really thinking too much about it. And it's those places, of course, where you're drifting. It's quite happily drifting along and you're not really paying any attention. It's when you realize that something's important that you have to be even more aware of it, right? So when I first move to Australia, we'd go down to the beach and, you know, my wife would say, you know, make sure you stay between the flags. And because I didn't grow up on the coast, the ocean still freaks me out a little bit. So I was
put your floaties on.
Well, not quite that bad, but pretty close. You know, so I was like, I'm going to stay between the flags. And I was amazed at how easy it was to be just kind of moved along the beach. You kind of look up and you'd be out of sync again. And so I think, first of all, being aware of what's important and having a really clear vision of what we think, like, what are we trying to achieve? I think when we don't have any clarity, it's super easy to drift.
Yeah.
Right? If you're just, I'm just going to sort of follow Jesus, I guess, and that's the best you can come up with in terms of a direction for your life. Oh, man, you're already drifting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that the other thing is, you know, I think the flags on the beach is a good analogy to some degree because you need to have a point of reference.
Yeah.
Right? Because a little bit of drift is okay, right? You can drift anywhere between the flags, right? You know,
and you're still in the safe zone.
And if you get a little bit outside of them, that's okay too. You just want to be able to say, well, where am I in relationship to the safe place to swim? Oh, okay, I'm a little bit outside, so I can move, be deliberate about moving back in. And so I think it's that clarity of what we're trying to achieve or who we're trying to become, of the things that we want to be growing in, the virtues that we hope to see develop and take root in our lives, the vices that we hope to see rooted out of our lives.
Yeah.
Having some clarity and a marker really helps us drift. Because if you don't have that, then who's to say that you've drifted anywhere?
Yeah.
You know, like nondescript landscape, maybe I've drifted, beats me. Yeah, 100 meters, 200 meters, 5 kilometers, don't know. So I think that those are the critical pieces.
Yeah.
And it's only when you've answered that you'll have any kind of clarity then around, have I drifted? You know?
And you got me thinking, because as you were talking about, I guess, that intentionality, like really when you want to get somewhere, when you make a plan, like I was instantly kind of taken back to like study and when I needed to get stuff done for study, which I can definitely drift in my studies. Let it be known. I know it's surprising for everyone, but you know, but you'd have to do like a Monday, I'm going to read these chapters. Tuesday, I'm going to summarize them. Wednesday, I'm going to start my essay, you know, all this kind of stuff. You'd create a plan that you would kind of work through. I find that helpful.
Which then gives you, shall we say, a bit of a checklist. Do you have a plan? And if you say no, well, okay, you might be drifting.
Yeah.
Do you have a clear idea about what you're trying to achieve? No. Okay, you might be drifting.
Yeah.
You're not necessarily drifting. You might just be standing still and becoming stagnant, which is a different problem.
Yeah.
So I think some of those, it kind of gives us a bit of a, gives you a diagnostic.
That makes sense. Super helpful questions to reflect on. Jodine, what stands out for you?
I think everything that Mark said, absolutely. I guess just to add to that, a sign that you're drifting can be a lack of consistency. Your day is like your life in miniature. So if you're not consistently doing particular things across most of your days, then you're probably not going to have that in your life. So it's a great, I guess, unit to start with. You know, does prayer show up in my day? Does spending time with God show up in my day? However large or small that is, and I think that speaks to the flags analogy as well. But if I'm not consistent in something, then obviously I don't value it as well. So I guess looking at what you're consistent in, and also looking at what you're consistent in the not so great areas as well. I had a bit of a revelation a couple of weeks ago or months ago about procrastination. I didn't think I was a really big procrastinator, but now I realize I actually am, and it's a form of self-sabotage. So I might be doing something and I'll just like, I'll quickly flick on my phone and just have a look at something, because it's just like an immediate relief from actually having to focus on the thing. Or I might go and do something that's still really good and helpful and appears to be like a good thing, but I'm not actually focusing on my task.
Yeah.
And I realized how inconsistent or how consistent I was at procrastinating, but in small amounts across the whole day. So when you look at the miniature things in your day, it starts to kind of, I guess, helps you unpick the puzzle of your life and then how you can get consistent across your whole life in the things you really want to value and spend time in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that idea of how easily we can be distracted, I think that also plays a part in it. We need to maybe have a bit of a, you know, we've talked about this before, a life audit. What are the things that are distracting us? Because yes, there are things within us that maybe we're not being intentional about that can result in drifting away. But, you know, there's also an external force that I think plays a role in our drifting away. And I think sometimes identifying the things in your life. I think, like, for me, Jodes, you and I cut from the same cloth. Like, my phone is, like, seriously. And I listened to a podcast the other day, and it was talking about like, mental health, and it was just talking about how your phone, like, we're seeking positive emotion, but we go to our phone and we don't receive it, but we think that we will, and that's why we're constantly going back to our phone. Like, man, the amount of times within an hour period that I pick up my phone, it's ridiculous. But, like, small example of just the distractions that I think, you know, play a role in our drifting away. What are the distractions that are happening in your life?
I think our life actually gives us more clues than we're willing to admit, and we have to really observe it. And there's a lot there for us to learn if we've got the capacity and, I guess, can slow down and look at our lives honestly.
Mm. Yeah, great. I think it's a good segue into our third and final question. Obviously, something that you said, Raider, in your message was that, you know, the reason that this community were drifting away was they just weren't paying enough attention to Jesus. I've got to admit, when you said that, the, like, voice in my head kind of was like, yeah, but what is enough? And I know that the Christian biblical response is we need to give all of ourselves, like, everything that we've got needs to go to Jesus. And that is true, and that is right, and that is good. But I do feel that that has become, an unhelpful Christian cliche if it's left as just that, you know, the bumper sticker, give your whole self to Jesus, pay more attention to Jesus. So this is where our third and final question is coming from. What does it look like to pay more attention to Jesus in our everyday life moments, which is ultimately the flip side to question two? Like, they were the things that lead us to drift away. What are the things that can bring us back in?
Yeah, I think I share your, I'm not sure if it's a frustration, but that sense of how much is enough. And that kind of just come back to the drifting analogy for a moment. There are times when it's nice to just drift, right? You know, but that has to be drifting for pleasure rather than drifting away from something that's important, right? So I think there's time for rest and relaxation, all that kind of stuff. I think one of the most helpful things to keep in mind when we're talking about our relationship with Jesus is that it's a relationship with Jesus. Yeah. And I think it's so easy for, I have no idea about other religions, but I know for Christians to want to quantify everything in the relationship with Jesus. And we can then end up feeling like it's never enough. And we don't do nearly enough, and how much is enough? And those are questions that speak to a dysfunctional relationship.
Yeah.
Right. So if you know, your relationship with a really close friend, or, you know, with your spouse, like, if you're constantly thinking what I'm doing is not enough, what does that say about your relationship?
Mm.
Like, it says that something's not quite right. Mm. The most fulfilling relationships are the ones where you feel like who I am is enough.
Mm.
But at the same time, in those relationships that are most significant and most meaningful, you always want to kind of grow those relationships.
Yep.
You want to deepen those relationships. And I think that's a helpful analogy. You know, like, you know, we're on the journey, according to the New Testament, of becoming like Jesus. And so I think that's where we get into that quantified kind of list of, okay, well, how like Jesus am I today versus how like Jesus was I yesterday? Am I more or less? And if I'm less, then what have I done wrong? And all of those sorts of things. But the relational component of it, I think, does help us sort of crack that nut a little bit. You know, you like to think, you know, we've all seen those, you know, those couples who've been married for 65 years, right? And they're just super comfortable with each other, but there's this deep and profound respect for each other, a love for each other, an honor of each other, deep experiences. There's just loads that just get said without speaking any words. You kind of think, well, if that's the relationship that I want with Jesus, how do you then develop that?
Mm.
Well, it's going to take time. Yeah. It's going to take some investment in the relationship, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's where it, you know, it's a little bit trickier with Jesus in some regards because you can't call him up and say, hey, let's go for a coffee, you know? And
wouldn't that be great though? Just FYI. It'd be
a whole lot easier to kind of go, I have a relationship with Jesus and actually going, all right, we caught up last week.
And, oh, gosh, you know, he paid for the coffee. It's like, it was just...
You'd hope so.
Bless him.
I own the cattle on a thousand hills and no cafes, so it's on you. But, you know, like I think you'd want to be thinking through, you know, relationally, what does it look like to have a deepened relationship? Mm. And I think it's when, you know, deep relationships are the ones where, you know, you want the person that you're in relationship with to succeed.
Mm.
You know, so how much do we want the plans and purposes of Jesus to succeed? You know, how often are we willing to do little things for our friends or those that we live with or, you know, partners and whatnot that just kind of make their life a little bit easier? You know, like, are we doing things that makes Jesus's plans and purposes in the world a little bit easier? Are we spending time in the Word? You know, the kind of the classics, you know, are we taking some time to pray? But I think that there's the thinking of Jesus, you know, that whole, what would Jesus do? The old bracelet thing.
Oh, I had one back in the day. Yeah, yes, I did.
There's something to that, you know, like, you know, those sorts of things I think become pretty important. Now that it's harder to quantify, but I think it's worth dealing with the mess of that and focus on the relationship rather than a list of do's and don'ts or some sort of scorecard where I'm more like Jesus today than I was yesterday and you know, where you can chart and graph everything, as much as I like charts and graphs.
yes you do. I've got to admit, what you just said really stood out to me, that whole idea of, you know, the people that I care about, I want them to succeed and I want to do what I can to assist them in that. Am I asking that question of what God is trying to achieve, of what Jesus is doing in our world? Like, I've got to admit, I don't think I've ever asked myself that question, and I work for a church. Like, this is going to become a staff review soon.
maybe it is now.
But what a great perspective to have. Like, what can I be doing today to further the work that Jesus is doing?
Not
that I think that it's contingent on what I can bring. Like, Jesus don't need me to get things done, but man,
but
like,
he's invited
powerful,
you too.
Yes.
And so I think it speaks into like generosity and being big hearted. How can I use my resources? Is there something I could do today that would make Jesus's job in the world just a little bit easier?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of how I speak or how I act or, you know, those sorts of things.
I love that. That's such a profound question. Mm. I'm going to probably start asking myself that. Jodine, how do you see this playing out in life?
I think sort of as Mark had talked about, it's starting with a place of generosity and compassion with ourselves. Often I think it's easy to rock up to our quiet time or whatever it is you do and start with a list of to-do things, of the things I haven't done, the things I feel guilty for, the things I'm a mess in. But Jesus embraces those with compassion, and so should we. So I feel like that's a really great place to start and always start. And that's across your whole life because it's so easy to slide, I think, as a human back into those patterns of I guess just negating yourself and your inability to have a relationship with God. So that's a really great place to start. I think, as Mark said, being intentional, small things daily, small things often, other things which join up to make the big picture. I think too often we're so quick to jump to the New Year's resolution kind of thing. Like, all right, I'm going to be doing this. I'm going to be like super fit by the end of the year. And, you know,
be a killer Christian.
By week two, we've like completely forgotten it and are just binge watching Netflix. Probably with a 2-liter tub of ice cream in your hand as well. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? We start so big with such huge pressure and demands on ourselves, and I guess we've got to nurture these things out of love and relationship, and that is not with heavy, strenuous demands. That never works. I think also doing it in relationship with other people, having an accountability partner, someone that you maybe just call up weekly and then maybe text once a week, to help you get through a season. It might be a seasonal thing. It might be a lifelong thing. Mm. You know, I've heard of people in our church that have been praying together for 40, 50, 60 years, a weekly prayer thing, which you wouldn't think would amount to much every week. You think, what do we do? But when you add that over decades, that's huge. So for ISO Life, one of my friends who I actually two of my friends who I rarely get to catch up with, one in Japan and one up on the northern beaches, we have made a pact to catch up. So one I do weekly, the girl up on the northern beaches, we ring each other weekly and we pray. Mm. And my friend in Japan, we catch up once a month on Skype.
Yeah.
And it has been absolutely brilliant, like the life that they have breathed into me and vice versa for such a time as this. It's been absolutely incredible. So I think sometimes we can be faced with opportunities and you think, how do I get out of this situation?
Yeah.
It's like, who can I bring in this situation to help me go through it? And it becomes such a like a Lord of the Rings moment where you got your little team and you're like, let's go.
Into Mordor.
Yeah. And you have a triumph together and that is so beautiful and you experience God so richly and those times become moments that you look back on your life, not only for yourself, but with your friends and your community around you as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
One does not simply walk into Mordor. But,
nice.
But I think, you know, the author to the Hebrews is focusing on one another as well. I think that's part of his message, exactly what Jodes was saying. And I think one of the skills that we need to help recreate is to how to have a spiritual conversation.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, we're pretty good at having, you know, those conversations about the weekend or about what you're getting up to. But to have a conversation about, so how you going in your relationship with God always seems a little bit awkward. So how do we have those conversations that either lead to prayer or lead to, you know, like a significant conversation about what we hope is a really significant part of our lives and how to do that in ways that don't feel awkward so we can normalize them, I think becomes a pretty important skill too.
Yeah. And I think on that, it ties into something you said, Jodes, which stood out to me, this whole idea of guilt. I think guilt, it has a power to let us drift away from Jesus because we don't want to bring the ugly, right? Like we, even to God, when we can't physically see his eye roll or his reaction, whatever we think we're going to get from him. Like I think there are so many Christians, particularly like young Christians, young kids who, you know, we see at youth, who they allow this guilt to really draw them away from God because there's such a shame of, oh, well, this is what I'm carrying. And I think that also plays a role in pulling us away from the people who can actually journey with us and speak into that space. But I actually think that when we get to a point, both with God, but with, you know, that fellowship of people, I'm just going to keep that going for as long as I can. You know, and then you have those real conversations where you can go, actually, let me just put it all on the table here. Like, this is what's really going on. Man, like, they're the conversations that you walk away from and you've got fresh air in your lungs and you feel lighter. Like, I think we need to acknowledge that guilt is a poison that we need to get rid of and that it's not... it won't have the same effect that we think it will. Does that make sense?
There may very well be some value in the act of confession.
Mm.
You know, a space where you can actually say, this is what's gone wrong.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes we do need to name that stuff and kind of go, it's not going real well right now. It's just not. You know, I haven't read my Bible for months. I can't pray. You know, whatever it is. And having someone who can hear that without judging and condemning.
Yeah.
Oh man, there's some incredible space for that. And while we might not kind of fall into a kind of Roman Catholic confession, there is something quite powerful about that space. Mm. That may be worth exploring.
You know,
in the sense of who can you be honest with in those spaces. So
Yeah, Jades.
I think shame and guilt can't survive when it's shared verbally, whether that's, like you say, through confession or when you share and talk amongst your friends or safe people. And it's always that thing, you're like, it can be so built up on your insides.
Yeah.
And then when you share it and then they go, okay, it's no big deal. And you're like, oh yeah, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's so powerful, the trust circle that you can build in your life. And I think... it also highlights that there's nothing that can go on in our lives that is not salvageable by God. And that's why he's the great creator we turn to, because he will restore and renew all things. And that's in every area of our lives.
Yeah. Great stuff. It seems ironic to me, guys, that we started the big three saying, hey, honor and shame doesn't apply to us anymore. And then we end on, man, like, we've got some shame. And but thank goodness that Jesus restores us in that. Like, go figure. Who would have thunk it? Well, thanks so much for coming and sharing with us today, guys. It's been awesome.
Great.
If you want to be a part of the conversation, make sure that you join us for our online services this Sunday at gbconline.org.au and that you snap the Slido QR code before the sermon to get involved. Don't forget, if you're listening to the podcast, we also film the Big Three, and that's now available at 7 p.m. on Wednesdays at GBC Online. If you've enjoyed the Big Three today, be sure that you give us a star rating and that you subscribe so that you can stay up to date on all future episodes. Well, thanks for joining us for this week's Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember, there's no thought too small, no question too big.